Morning. For those of you that I know, welcome. For those of you that I don't know, you're also welcome here, and I'm glad that you are here. However, if you are new to our church, dropping in for the first time or haven't been here in a while, once again, welcome. However, you are going to have an interesting time here this morning because you're going to have to eavesdrop in on a conversation that we have been having as a church for a while. Because we are in the middle of the book of 1 Corinthians, which I would invite you to take out now. We're going to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Don't be afraid to use the table of contents if you can't find it. We're in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, which means that we have been in this series now for quite a number of weeks where we are examining what Paul is saying to a church in a particular time and place. Okay? And that's going to be really important today. This is a particular conversation going on in space and time, and it's a place that's different than our own. So we, as a church, have actually been eavesdropping in on Paul's conversation with his church. See, Paul spent about 18 months in the church of Corinth. He planted it. He spent time ministering there. He was getting to know these people, and then he had to leave about 18 months later. So he had been having ongoing conversations with them. And then after he leaves, a little while later, he sends them a letter. And it's not this letter. And then they, in turn, respond back to his letter. So that we've had an exchange happen now. And 1 Corinthians, the book that we are looking at today, is the next letter in that ongoing conversation between Paul and a church. Okay? So we are eavesdropping in on their conversation. You've eavesdropped before. You know the dangers of eavesdropping, right? Someone calls your house and your spouse or your roommate picks up the phone and they say immediately, "Glad you called back. So, picking up where we left off," and then they go on from there. So, picking up where we left off, that's what Paul's doing today. And in fact, if your spouse or your roommate says, "Glad you called today, so picking up where we left off in that conversation," the bar has been moved. That's what they say in the phone. The bar's been moved, and you have no idea now what they're talking about. Is it a bar of music that they've been talking about? Is that what the conversation has been about? They've been composing something and they need to move a bar of music around. Is it a pub that they're gonna meet at and it's relocated? The bar's been moved, what do we do? Where are we gonna meet now? You don't know, because you weren't part of that conversation. Maybe it's a bar in their house, right? Something has shifted, they need to put some supports in place. Maybe it's a conversation with a contractor. Maybe they're talking about raising a standard. The bar's been moved, the bar's dropped, we need to raise the bar again. Is that what they're talking about? This is the danger that happens in eavesdropping in on a conversation. And we're going to encounter some of those dangers this morning. So as I said, Paul understands these people really well, and it's an ongoing conversation that he has been having with the church around issues that they are facing. It's sort of like, the situation is sort of like if Rob and I or I preached a sermon on refugees, right? We as a church have been talking about refugees. We are actually going to be hoping to support a family of refugees coming over. But that conversation has also taken place within the wider cultural conversation that's happening in Canada and North America right now around what do we do about refugees, right? Conversations take place not just between individuals, but also within a wider culture, and they evoke certain things. And those are going to come out this morning. This morning's topic is marriage, divorce, and singleness. These are the things that Paul was addressing. And he wasn't addressing something out of the blue. These were conversations happening in their culture at that time. Now, because we are taking three different topics and we're putting them together, and you may only find yourself in one or two of those situations, I would invite you nevertheless to pay attention even when maybe you are single and I'm addressing married people. Because, you might be married at some point, but all of you know people who are married, and you want to listen for them as well. You want to know how to support other people who are in this position. If you are married, those of us who are married need to honestly think about how we can support single people and what God says to them. And the same goes for people contemplating divorce. So let's listen for the sake of the other as well as for ourselves. Last week was a pretty exciting sermon, if you remember. Rob spoke mostly about sex, which was, you know, everyone pays very close attention when you talk about sex. They look like a deer in the headlights, but nonetheless, everyone is very focused, which is a lot of fun. I'm actually a little jealous. We are going to talk about sex today, too, so don't worry, you're not getting. You didn't miss out if you didn't get it last week. But Rob introduced a really important concept that's important for understanding this passage today. He talked about the dualism that happens, that was a part of the ancient world. This was a belief that spiritual things matter, physical things don't. Okay, that was part of their culture. That's what they bring to any conversation. Spiritual things matter, physical things don't. Okay, that had two effects on married people when it comes to Corinth. Okay, the first effect is that people in the church are saying, spiritual things matter, physical things don't. The body must be evil. So we need to suppress those urges that we get. We got to focus on the spiritual stuff. Forget any sort of physical bodily urges, right? And then they say, look at Paul. He's celibate, right? He's not following those urges. He doesn't need to be married, right? Maybe that's the example that we should follow. And what's happening is some spouses in this church are shutting the bedroom door on the other spouse. You understand what I mean by that, right? Right? Okay? One spouse is shutting the bedroom door, okay? And the next logical step, if you go down that road of saying spiritual things matter, we got to suppress these bodily urges, is that they're then going to say, well, my spouse might still tempt me, so really we better get divorced. And that's why the issue of divorce is going to be raised. But then there's the opposite thing that happens. Some spouses say, can't do that physical stuff, spiritual stuff only. The other part of dualism is that some people are saying, well, it doesn't really matter what I do with my body. It's only the spiritual stuff that matters. I can do whatever I want with my body, with whomever I want. And that's the other thing that's happening in this church as well. And some of them are saying, okay, if only the spiritual things matter, I can go downtown. I can visit Aphrodite's temple downtown. There were actually three temples to Aphrodite in this city. And what happens when you worship Aphrodite is you actually do have sex with a temple prostitute. That was a huge part of their culture. So can you see this vicious circle that's happening? One spouse is shutting the bedroom door. Another spouse is saying, well, I've got urges and I'm going elsewhere. And Paul has got to deal with both of these. What is he going to do? He brings it up. They have actually brought it up in their letter to Paul, and Paul is now bringing this up back to them. So he says, concerning the things about which you wrote. That's the first verse in chapter 7. In other words, picking up the conversation where we have left it off, and he's going to start talking now about marriage. And maybe just before we get into this passage, you can take a look at it, but just before we get into it, we probably shouldn't assume that this is women shutting the bedroom door and it's only men who are going downtown, okay? Because look at what he says in verse 1. It is good for a man not to touch a woman. So who's shutting the bedroom door? Okay? So let's just think about that because it could go either way, right? Let's just keep this in mind. Read with me. Starting at verse 1. Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. He's quoting them. That's why it's in quotation marks. That's what they've written in their letter. But because of cases of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a set time to devote yourselves to prayer. And then come again together. Come together again quickly so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. And I say this as a concession, not as a command. I love the way the Bible is really honest about sex and about the goodness of sex. God is not your grandmother, okay? If you grew up with that grandmother who sex is a really touchy subject, it's actually sort of improper, you shouldn't raise it. No offense to grandmothers, but there are people who are like this, right? God is not your grandmother. Sex is good. From the Bible's point of view, if it is within marriage, and the Bible celebrates the goodness of sex. I actually had a prof in school who used to say to some of the people in the class, he'd say, do you guys like sex? You guys interested in sex? Yeah, to get to know God. He's the one that invented it. What do you think about that? You ought to get to know the God who invented sex. He's pretty creative. I think he knows how to have a good time, right? Notice what Paul says here. He encourages mutuality for the sake of the other person. This is about meeting the needs of someone else. This isn't about having all of our own needs met. Sex is the expression of what marriage is supposed to be. What does Paul say in Ephesians? Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Marriage is about putting someone else first, not ourselves. And he does say, don't deprive one another. No shutting the bedroom door, no going to prostitutes. Have each other. That's what he says. Have each other. The only exception for not having each other, he says, is for prayer. Brief periods of prayer, he says. And as the passage actually makes explicit, the answer to sexual temptation isn't prayer. I got one laugh. Seriously, the answer to sexual temptation, according to Paul, isn't prayer. Okay, what is it? Look at the passage. It's each other. It is your privilege to help your spouse avoid sexual temptation. I think Paul would also say that a sexless marriage is like a check engine light, where that marriage might keep going, that car might keep running, but you better get it to the shop. Paul's overarching message that's going to come up both in marriage, divorce, singleness, through this whole chapter, is make the best of it. Make the best of your marriage. I don't mean put up with it as in, you know, do the best you can do. I mean like make your marriage flourish. Paul says the way to do that is through submitting to one another, through giving yourself to the other person. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for it. So when you have died for your wife, you will have fulfilled that command. Okay? Let's put the other person first. Paul moves on to a very touchy subject after this. He moves on to talk to people who are contemplating divorce. Now, remember at the beginning I said that all communication has a context? People hate it when their words are taken out of context, right? Words only have meaning within the context of a conversation, but a conversation takes place within a historical context as well. So, for example, in 1816, let's put ourselves back 200 years. If in 1816 someone says, I'm gay, what do they mean? They're happy. They're not coming out of the closet, right? In 2016, if someone says, I've come out of the closet, no one thinks you're Harry Potter and have been living under the broom, in the broom cupboard under the stairs, right? Because conversations take place within a historical context, and they evoke certain things in that culture that everyone else understands. All right? Now track with me, because in ancient Greek and Roman culture, they're having a conversation about divorce. And Paul is going to contribute to that conversation. The ancient Greek world had no-fault divorce. If you don't know what that term means, no-fault divorce means that either spouse can file for divorce without having to provide a reason. So there doesn't have to be any sort of, he did such and such, I don't like it anymore, I've got to give that reason. No, they had no-fault divorce. You could get divorced for any reason. And that means that it left women, particularly, vulnerable. Vulnerable. Socially ostracized and destitute. The Jewish law permitted divorce, provided that the husband give a reason. Okay? And so what happened, Moses gives this law in Deuteronomy 24 that the husband has to provide a reason for it. It's got to be written down. He's got to give her this certificate of divorce. Well, what happened since Moses' time and up to Jesus' time and up to Paul's is that all of the Jewish rabbis then debated with one another about what were the valid reasons a husband could give for getting a divorce. You follow me? Okay? And there's one popular school of thought, very popular school of thought, that said, a husband can give any reason he wants, he's just got to write it down. So if she burnt my toast this morning, I can get a divorce. And that's actually written down, okay? I'm not making this up. If she burns the food, you can give her a divorce, okay? If she has a freckle that you don't like, and I'm paraphrasing, but I'm basically quoting them, you can get a divorce, okay? If someone catches your eye that you like better, you can get a divorce. That's one school of Jewish thought. And that's the debate that's happening in the first century, okay? That's the debate that Jesus and Paul are weighing in on, okay? Please keep that in mind. So when Jesus talks about divorce, someone has raised that issue, okay? That's the wider cultural conversation happening. The Pharisees come to Jesus and ask him about divorce. The other time he talks about it is in the Sermon on the Mount. And he doesn't just pontificate out of the blue. He says, you have heard it was said, right? They're having that ongoing conversation, and Jesus is going to contribute to it. So when we read in this passage, and when we read what Jesus says, and they say, no divorce, you need to hear what's in their minds, okay? And I'm saying that for the sake of saying what I'm going to say now, okay? Hear me very carefully, please. What does not appear to be in their minds is the situation in which the woman is being physically abused and Jesus and Paul are still saying, you have to stay married. Have you heard me clearly? Okay? That's not what is in view, as far as I can tell, in that wider cultural conversation in which Paul and Jesus are referring to. And I bring that up because, frankly, some women have been abused in the church, and the pastor or the elders have sent them back to their husband. And I don't want you to hear that this morning. I want to uphold the sanctity of marriage and the seriousness with which Paul and Jesus take marriage, and they take it very, very seriously. But it is not without exception. And I'm saying that also not as the final word, but as the ongoing conversation that we should have around divorce. Okay? Let's look at our text. Starting at verse 10. Paul says, to the married I give this command, and not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does separate, let her remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not divorce his wife. Now notice, Paul says, this is God's command, this isn't mine. No divorce. Marriage is for life. Marriage is for life. That is the design that God had in mind for marriage. So let's not treat people like they are objects to be used as long as we are sort of in the mood for that. And then if our feelings change or it gets hard, we can walk away. Don't sign up for life and then leave when it gets hard. That's God's command. That's the ideal. I'm sure you have heard that before. But what often hasn't been noticed is what Paul then does after he says that. But if the wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, Paul recognizes that they don't live in the Garden of Eden anymore. Okay? Paul recognizes that life is more complex than one command. Okay? But if she leaves, he says. In other words, separation is by no means the ideal, but concessions can be made for extreme situations. In that case, he says, the partner who leaves has two options: remain single, because they're still married, or reconcile. He wants them to work it out. Marriage is permanent. Separation is conceded. It's forbidden for those who are looking to trade up. Right? Paul says, make the best of it. Make the best of it. No divorce. Work it out. Reconcile. And then he goes on to address what he calls mixed marriages. In other words, interfaith marriages. Someone is a Christian, another is a non-believer. Okay? What he says to them is similar. He says, stay married. But if, again, if the non-Christian decides to walk away and leave, that's okay, he says. There's another concession. But otherwise, make the best of it. Because you never know how God might use you in that situation with your spouse. You never know. Paul and Jesus don't set out a whole theology of divorce. And I haven't done so either, okay? I've tried to bring a little bit more light to that conversation, but this is not the final word, okay? It's something that we need to consider and wrestle with together and see what God does. There's an ongoing dialogue. Now, we've left out our single people. Paul really, really values singleness. I don't know if you've picked that up before. Paul really, really values singleness. So look at verses 32 to 35. I'll have them on the screen. I'm reading from Eugene Peterson's paraphrase, The Message. He does an absolutely fantastic job with this entire section of this letter. So I would really encourage you to read this whole passage in The Message sometime. It is fantastic. Here's what he says starting in verse 32. I want you to live as free of complications as possible. When you're unmarried, you're free to concentrate on simply pleasing the master. By the master, he means God, right? Marriage involves you in all the nuts and bolts of domestic life and in wanting to please your spouse, leading to so many more demands on your attention. The time and energy that married people spend on caring for and nurturing one another, the unmarried can spend in becoming whole and holy instruments for God. I'm trying to be helpful and to make it as easy as possible for you, not to make things harder. All I want is for you to be able to develop a way of life in which you can spend plenty of time together with the Master without a lot of distraction. Paul doesn't just value singleness, he actually recommends it. So if you are single today, you are not a second-class citizen, okay? Paul was single. Jesus was single. There is a high view of singleness in Scripture. So for those of us who are married, let's stop treating single people like we need to fix them, okay? They don't need to be fixed, right? They're not weird. Paul values singleness. He actually recommends it. He recommends it if you can manage to do it without what he says is burning with passion, right? That's an innuendo, right? That's a euphemism, right? He says, but if you can do it, you can accomplish so much more as a single person than those who are married. And we ought to consider that. He recommends it. He doesn't in any way denigrate marriage. But he says that if you have a gift for celibacy, if you can do it, you're actually better off. You're going to have more opportunities to serve God, and you can make this world a better place in the way that married people can't. Because your priorities won't be as divided. That's pretty cool, right? Paul holds up singleness. Further to that, he actually gives a warning about marriage to single people. He says marriage is hard work. Would anyone like to nod and agree? Marriage is hard work. Marriage is not all roses, okay? And family life, I will just be honest with you, family life is even harder, okay? This is tough stuff that we are involved in. It's like the woman who says to her fiancé, when we're married, I want to share all of your troubles and your concerns with you. And he says, I don't have any troubles. I don't have any concerns or worries. And she replies, yeah, but we're not married yet. Right? Right? Let's just be honest about marriage is actually hard. And Paul says that explicitly in this passage. I didn't quote the exact verse, but Paul says it. He says, I want to spare you some of that trouble. Okay? Paul has open eyes about the goodness of marriage, but also some of the difficulties. He says the marriage will have trouble. Lastly, he also speaks to those who are looking to get married, and he says, marry a Christian. So if you're dating, if you're engaged, marry a Christian. Not because Christians are better than anyone else. That's not what he's saying. That is not what I am saying. He says, marry a Christian because if you don't, that central part of your life, you will be divided over in your marriage, and it will cause problems. And Paul says, I would spare you of that. Okay? Marry a Christian. Paul doesn't bring this up, but I do want to raise it just out of pastoral concern for a moment. How can we as married people support single people who wish they were married and it hasn't worked out for them yet? I'm sure faces are coming to mind when you think about that person. And I just want to raise that for a moment. Let's start by not treating them like they are incomplete. Okay? Paul values marriage, but he also values singleness, and Jesus was a single person who did not have an incomplete life because he didn't get married. Let's also not give them false hope, okay? I'm just going to say it as blatantly as I think it should be said. It's a lie. I think it's a lie when people say there's someone for everyone or God has a person for you and you better find the one. That's a really dangerous thing to say to people, okay? Please don't give them false hope, right? How else can we support single people? How about having them over? When you have another family over to your house, why not invite a single person, but then make sure that you don't only talk about children, right? Okay? Take an interest in their lives as well. Because frankly, children can sort of be that lowest common denominator of conversation between people sometimes. Like, take an interest in their life as well. But let's include them in our activities. And finally, maybe to support single people, maybe something which I've tried to do this morning is to be honest about marriage is hard, okay? Marriage isn't all roses, okay? Let's actually be honest about the genuine ups and downs of life together, okay? Let's not treat them as though they will be incomplete until they find someone. So Paul says to singles, make the best of it. He says, don't wish your life away. Make the best of it is the central message of this passage. Make the best of it. Eugene Peterson, again, in verse 17, you'll see it on the screen. He says, don't be wishing you were someplace else or with someone else. Where you are right now, where you are right now is God's place for you. Live and obey and love and believe where you are now. God, not your marital status, defines your life. God, not your marital status, defines your life. He says, make the best of it. Make the best of what you have right now in whatever situation you find yourself in, because that's where God has you. God is not waiting to start using you years down the road when you hook up. God wants to use you right now, wherever you are. We sang that song earlier, Lord, Reign in Me. Not, Lord, maybe reign in me down the road when you make my dreams come true, but reign in me right now, because now is the place where you have me. Now is the place where you want to use me. That's what we're talking about. So if you are single, please serve God wholeheartedly where you are now. Entrust your dreams to God and prioritize His dream for you. Okay? You have value. You have so much that you can offer. And Paul recognizes that he doesn't want to let that just slip away. Right? You have something that the rest of us married people can't offer. Don't let your desires for marriage undermine the life you have right now. Don't wish it were something different. Use the opportunities God has given you. And if you're single and it's not killing you, you might want to consider Paul's advice to stay single, to accomplish more, to serve God without distraction. It's good advice. Now, if you're married, remember what he says to married people, make the best of it. Marriage isn't easy. And sometimes you might regret your decision, but make the best of it. Don't dwell on the past. Find out how God wants to reign in you right now in your marriage, because he can do something with it, even if it's tough. Explore God's design for marriage, one that gives you an opportunity to have a life of service alongside someone else, serving someone else, giving your life up for that other person. And if you are contemplating divorce, make the best of it. Work towards reconciliation. Get help. Consider your marriage for life. Consider a lifetime commitment. But do not read Paul or Jesus or hear this message as condoning abuse and sending you back into an abusive situation. Paul says to those who are in mixed marriages, if you become a Christian and your spouse hasn't yet, or maybe your spouse left the faith, make the best of it and see what God does through it, because your story isn't over yet. That story has not been completed, and you don't know how God may be working in the life of that spouse who has left the faith. Okay? We are stewards of the life that we have, not the one that we wish we had. In 1943, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was imprisoned for opposing the Nazis. Shortly after, he had just become engaged to a woman named Maria. And 6 months after he'd been imprisoned, his best friend got married. That must have been hard. He could have become depressed. He could have just railed against the injustice of it all. Life is not fair. Why are the things that I wished for happening not to me, but to my best friend? He could have become really bitter. Instead, what he did was he wrote them letters of encouragement through their engagement and even after the wedding had happened. He wrote them letters of encouragement. Can you imagine that? This is a prisoner encouraging people on the outside. Like, just think about that for a second. And then shortly after that, his best friend and his wife, they have their first child. And once again, he writes letters of encouragement to them. In fact, for both the marriage and for the child's baptism, they're Lutheran, they baptize infants, and for both, it would have been Dietrich Bonhoeffer who would have officiated that marriage and who would have officiated the baptism. And so what he does is he actually writes them the sermons that he would have given if he could have been there, and he sends them to him because he wanted to be an encouragement to them. He wanted to be there as much as possible. He wanted to make the best of the situation that he was in. And then he's executed. 2 years later, he spends 2 years in jail, never gets out, never gets married, never has the dreams that he had hoped for realized. They aren't. But what we discover afterwards is that he had written many, many, many letters, books in prison. He'd made the most of his time there. He'd made the best of it. And those are the legacy that he has left to so many people as a result. Life is not easy. It does not always bring us what we want, but God asks us to make the best of whatever situation we are in. That's what Paul envisions. Paul hopes that our dreams for life will be subsumed under God's dreams for us and for this world.